British ambassador in Washington resigns after his scathing memo was leaked and drew strong words from President Trump. The ambassador's supporters and his boss insist he did nothing wrong.
Good government depends on public servants being able to give full and frank advice.
I'm Marco Werman. We dig into all the factors that led to Ambassador Kim Darroch's downfall. Plus, the UN special envoy to Yemen briefs us on the long civil war right after he briefs Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And the last Volkswagen Beetle rolls off the assembly line in Mexico.
You know, that vehicle was barely fast enough to get out of its own way.
Saying goodbye again to the VW bug. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. 4 extraordinary days for the UK's ambassador to the US. Sir Kim Darroch resigned from his post today. But the story started Sunday when a memo Darroch wrote with a scathing assessment of the Trump administration was leaked. Then President Trump said he'd have nothing more to do with him, tweeting that Ambassador Darroch is, quote, a very stupid guy and a pompous fool. But believe it or not, that was not the final straw that pushed the diplomat to resign. This was.
Just tell us the answer.
Okay,
go on, Boris.
Well,
all right, you haven't liked answering.
So would you like to keep him beyond Christmas when he normally retires?
Well, he's
a debate last night between the two men vying to become the next British Prime Minister. One, the former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. The other, the current Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt.
So you're going to keep him you wouldn't extend his term out of sympathy?
I will keep him until he's due to retire,
okay.
And I think we'd like to know if you would.
Well, I'm not going to be so presumptuous.
Bottom line, Hunt stood by Ambassador Darroch, Johnson refused to. And with Johnson the favorite in the race, Darroch felt he had to quit. Much to the regret of his current boss, Prime Minister Theresa May.
The whole cabinet rightly gave its full support to Sir Kim on Tuesday. Sir Kim has given a lifetime of service to the United Kingdom, and we owe him an enormous debt of gratitude. Good government depends on public servants being able to give full and frank advice.
Earlier today, I spoke with David Miliband about all this. He served as the UK's top diplomat and worked with Darroch.
I think it is sad, that very sad, that Anglo-American relations should have been reduced to this, that a public servant should have been vilified and then not supported. And what it speaks to about the age of diplomacy is the danger that everything gets politicized and everything then gets polarized.
We'll hear more from David Miliband later in the show about his current work as head of the International Rescue Committee. Right now, though, we stay on Ambassador Darroch's resignation. What happens when a diplomat's full and frank advice is scathing, as Ambassador Darroch's was about the Trump administration, and then it gets leaked? Ambassador Nicholas Burns teaches the practice of diplomacy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Nick, what did Kim Darroch do wrong?
He didn't do anything wrong. He did exactly what diplomats do, including our own diplomats, including me in a previous life as ambassador. You have to tell the truth to your own government about what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're sensing about the place you're in. And you do that usually by confidential or secret cables so that the audience is limited. And someone in the British government leaked these cables to the Daily Mail to embarrass, I think, those who are opposing the Brexit agreement. And it did a tremendous disservice to Ambassador Darroch. I think he was also victimized, Marco, by President Trump. Now, it couldn't have been easy for Donald Trump to read what Ambassador Darroch said in this private channel to London. But the President of the United States then blackballed the ambassador, said he was not welcome in Washington, effectively made it impossible for him to do his job. And this is the ambassador of the United Kingdom, our closest friend along with Canada in the world. And I think the president, who is often so vain and so sensitive, should have put aside his hurt feelings and done the best thing for the country. He should have ignored it. He didn't have to be best friends with the ambassador, but you don't create a crisis with the British government at the same time. So I think there were two sins here, and poor Ambassador Darroch stuck in the middle, the victim.
Trump is also scathing about British Prime Minister Theresa May. How unusual is it for a head of state like Donald Trump to then publicly attack the ambassador and government of a friendly nation?
It is completely unprecedented in the American experience. I was trying to search my memory. Has there been a time when an American president, any previous occupant of the Oval Office, was this disrespectful to the British people and the British government the British ambassador? And the answer is no. Now, I mean, I understand in human terms, if I were President Trump and I'd read what was said about him, you'd be furious. That would be the initial reaction. But you're the president. You've got to put aside your hurt feelings and vanity, and you've got to do the right thing for the United States, which is not to have a crisis with the British people and British government, especially at this sensitive time concerning Brexit.
Nicholas Burns, former ambassador and current professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
In his resignation letter, Ambassador Darroch said he could no longer effectively do his job following President Trump's comments about him. That's the official version. I asked Rob Watson, the BBC's political correspondent in London, for the backstory.
The key part of the backstory, and this is pretty explosive for Boris Johnson and feeds into the whole Brexit imbroglio here in the UK, is that we had learned that the BBC and other journalists had learned is that the final straw for Sir Kim was when Boris Johnson refused to give him his backing when he was engaged in a television debate with Jeremy Hunt, who's the other candidate to try and succeed Theresa May as Conservative Party leader and, of course, as Prime Minister. And, of course, it's raised this issue, you know, what on earth is Boris Johnson doing, choosing to take the side, if you like, of President Trump and the White House against Her Majesty's ambassador in the UK. It's as sort of blunt and as brutal as that.
Right. I mean, during that televised debate last night, it's kind of hard to hear exactly what they're saying. And Jeremy Hunt, the rival to become prime minister, is in the mix. But it was lively.
It certainly was. I mean, if I had to sum up the debate, though, it would be feisty but futile. And why I mean, why I say feisty is there was an awful lot of talking over each other and, you know, how to deal with President Trump, what to do about Sir Kim was part of that disagreement. But I say futile because one suspects that those who are in a position to elect Boris Johnson, and that is the small number of Conservative Party members, about 160,000 of them, they like Mr. Johnson. An awful lot of them have probably already voted. And because they like him so much and they like his sort of positive attitude towards Brexit, I think even something as awkward and as embarrassing and difficult as this probably won't make much difference. Certainly not to his attempts to become Prime Minister. Where I think this is immensely important is how will it affect his time in office when he becomes a prime minister, to have Britain's civil service, the sort of the permanent officials, the neutral officials who carry out the work of the government, presumably being rather suspicious of the new man at number 10.
Yeah, so why would a prospective prime minister like Boris Johnson not defend officials of the government he would have to lead?
I think the explanation for that has been provided by some in his campaign team, which is that they, you know, put simply, they are prioritizing a good relationship between Mr. Johnson and President Trump. Now, that, of course, has led critics of Mr. Johnson and of Brexit to say, hey, look, this is exactly what we warned you about when we said not to vote Leave in the referendum, that it would necessarily involve Britain having to pivot away from Brussels more towards Washington, and what? Basically having to suck up to whoever was in the White House, that no matter how critical the president has been of the prime minister, of Theresa May, of an ambassador, you just have to suck it up because that's the new reality of Britain's place in the world.
The head of the Foreign Service has said this is all very unprecedented. What do we know about the leaker and how this highly classified diplomatic cable actually got leaked?
We don't. I mean, there's been all sorts of speculation. I mean, was it hacking by the Russian state? Was it leaked by someone who's really enthusiastic by Brexit and wanted to get rid of an ambassador that they didn't consider to be Brexity enough? Or was it leaked by someone who thinks that Brexit is a really crazy idea and that this would complicate relations, expose the difficulty of that pivot that I was talking about from Brussels to Washington? I mean, we simply don't know. But I think what you can say is this, is that it feeds into the extraordinary stresses and strains that the whole Brexit process has put on the entire British system. And in particular, that system we have here that's rather respected, where you have a sort of division of labour between elected politicians who decide policy on the one hand, and bureaucrats, unelected officials, the civil service, who sort of get on with what it is that the politicians tell them to do.
The BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson speaking with us from London. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Marco.
Today, we say goodbye to an old friend, an automotive icon. Volkswagen is halting production of the Beetle. For real this time, we think. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
In 1999, there was a competition to name the car of the century. No surprise, the Ford Model T came in first, then the Mini, then the Citroën DS, and in fourth place, the Volkswagen Beetle. There truly was no other car like it, a tiny round bubble with an engine in back. Everybody could instantly identify the bug. It was Bernard Zwicky's first car, a present from his parents for his 16th birthday in 1993.
It was a 1972 Beetle in yellow. So I really understand how folks get emotional and attached to these vehicles. It just had a whole different look than everything else. You know, that rear-located engine, it sounded different going down the road.
Zwicky is now with the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He loved his Beetle, but the car had its limitations.
You know, that vehicle was barely fast enough to get out of its own way.
Paradoxically, that's part of what made it so fun. Zwicky says Beetle owners took great pride in tricking out their cars.
Everything from the front bumper to the rear bumper. So certainly engine performance is always a key thing to modify. One heck of a lot of interior customization with different seats, colors, customized paint jobs. I mean, literally the entire vehicle is an open palette for someone to express themselves.
Commercials for the Beetle didn't even need words, just images. The Beetle was cool, hip, a symbol of 60s counterculture. The car was also affordable. There was another selling point to it, good gas mileage.
If you're starting out to see the USA, you may not get very far.
Volkswagen advertised that the Beetle got about twice the gas mileage of the average car. For all of its later successes, the Beetle had ignominious beginnings. It was developed in 1938 in Nazi Germany. Adolf Hitler wanted an affordable vehicle for the masses. And so the People's Car, designed by Ferdinand Porsche, was born. By the 1960s, the past was mostly forgotten, and the Beetle had become a movie star.
What's going on?
Herbie's magic will be unleashed on the world.
Disney produced six movies about Herbie, an anthropomorphic beetle with a mind of its own.
He's Herbier.
The Beetle sold nearly 23 million units over 80 years, but by 2017, sales had ground to a trickle. Dave Cole, chair of Auto Harvest in Ann Arbor, says the Beetle is no longer in sync with the times. Car buyers throughout the world want crossover vehicles, basically small SUVs.
And when you look at the Beetle as an example, you carry a few people, not much stuff. And what the marketplace is basically saying is we want more flexibility in the vehicles that we buy.
Volkswagen shifted production of the Beetle from Germany to Mexico in the late 1970s. The last Beetle will roll off the line today at the plant in Puebla. The end of an era. Or is it? The original Beetle was actually canceled 16 years ago, but replaced by a new Beetle, similar in style, but with a more powerful engine in front. Dave Cole says predicting the future of cars today is impossible.
Who knows what the marketplace is going to do? And we have seen the resurrection of sort of Beetle 2 after Beetle 1. Is there going to be a Beetle 3? We don't know.
The head of the VW Group of America says the car maker has no plans to revive the Beetle, but added, quote, never say never. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
The old Beetle might be a rarity on the roads these days, but in Ethiopia, diehard fans keep their love bugs running with the help of resourceful mechanics. Check that out at theworld.org, and while you're at it, share your VW Beetle snapshots on our Facebook page. We're at PRI The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Trump administration said today that Iran is guilty of crude extortion. In a statement to the United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency, the U.S. said there is no credible reason for Iran to be expanding its nuclear program other than to extort money from the international community. It's been more than a year since President Trump decided to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. Britain, France, and Germany are still trying to keep the agreement going. But as The World's Matthew Bell reports, the rising tensions between Washington and Tehran are making that seem less and less likely. That's Hassan Rouhani, Iran's president, speaking at a cabinet meeting today in the Iranian capital. The Americans, he said, who are violating the terms of the nuclear deal, are now asking why Iran is not meeting its commitments under that deal. Rouhani said you can't find a funnier story in the political history of the world. The Iranians say they have not violated the terms of the nuclear agreement they signed in 2015. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht-e Ravanchi, talked to the BBC today. He said the Islamic Republic will take additional steps on uranium enrichment if the Europeans fail to deliver economic rewards promised as part of the deal.
When President Trump decided to get out of the nuclear deal, we were approached by three European leaders encouraging us, insisting Iran not to get out of the nuclear deal, and they promised us to do exactly what they were supposed to do to compensate what we have lost as a result of the U.S. withdrawal. So it is not acceptable to us to see that the Europeans are not honoring their commitments.
Today, a top French diplomat is in Iran to try to find a way forward. The Europeans are also calling on Iran to reverse its decision to boost uranium enrichment activities. All along, Iran has said its nuclear program is entirely for peaceful purposes. That's not always been true, according to a trove of Iranian documents said to be stolen by Israel. William Tobey of Harvard University was part of a delegation that traveled to Tel Aviv earlier this year to look at the stolen Iranian nuclear archive. He says it appeared to be authentic and instructive.
I've seen the remnants of other illicit nuclear programs before in Iraq and Libya. And to my mind, this was immensely more capable and better organized.
Tobey says the documents show that Iran had secretly made more progress with its nuclear program than experts in the West realized.
There were detailed plans for production schedules for the intermediate steps toward producing a nuclear weapon, toward conducting nuclear tests, etc. And all these things were very well preserved in the archive.
But Tobey says the archive also revealed something else important, that Iran decided in 2003 to halt its existing nuclear weapons program. So knowing what he knows now, does William Tobey think that the Iran nuclear deal was effective? Yes and no, he says. Iran did get rid of nearly all of its supply of low-enriched uranium and cut its enrichment capacity dramatically. Those were the successful parts of the deal brokered by the Obama administration. But the deal fell short, Tobey says, because it never required Iran to make a complete declaration of its nuclear-related programs. And the duration of the deal was too short, only 10 years. Does that mean the U.S. quitting the Iran nuclear agreement was a good idea?
In my view, you don't solve the duration issue by ending the deal. You actually compound it.
The key question now is how any new agreement might address Iran's nuclear capabilities, and if the Trump administration and the Iranian government are willing to negotiate one. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Earlier this week, we learned that Pierre Mambele had died. Definitely not a household name here in the U.S., but for many who know and report about the Democratic Republic of Congo, Pierre Mambele means a lot. For decades, Mambele served as a guide, fixer, and friend to foreign journalists flying into the DRC on assignment. Howard French is a former New York Times West Africa correspondent. I asked him to describe what Pierre Mambele did for him and other reporters who came to Kinshasa.
Pierre would never have described himself as anything other than a driver. However, no one who ever worked with Pierre would have described him simply as a driver. Pierre was an extraordinarily resourceful and self-confident man. Not every one of your listeners will remember this television show, but when I grew up, there was a popular TV show called Columbo, which involved a disheveled detective. And Pierre had a strong aspect of that in him. He wore dirty jeans and typically a grimy T-shirt with his pot belly prominently exposed. And Pierre was completely unapologetic about this. None of that seemed to matter to him. He drove a bashed-up car that was a miracle in itself that it continued to function over so many years. And yet behind this affect was this extraordinary human being who just knew how to make things work, who knew how to sniff out danger, who knew how to rescue inexperienced reporters from their own silliness. And no one who worked with Pierre, as I said, would ever have simply thought of him as a driver.
One of the things that struck me as I read his obituary, his kind of skills as a negotiator, were you with him in any sticky or even nasty situations? Like, what silliness did you commit that he got you out of?
Oh, I was in lots of bad situations with him. Journalists were always getting stopped, robbed, and sometimes detained. And Pierre knew how, in ways that I can't even still fully explain, how to confidence himself out of the grips of the police, even in the worst of periods. I remember, for example, a period when there was unrest by the army because their pay had been held up for a long period of time. And Pierre and I had gone out somewhere and they tried to seize me. And they told him, look, we're not interested in you. We're not interested in your car or its papers. We want the journalist. And Pierre just simply wouldn't let go and followed the police as they took me away, found a way to figure out who he needed to talk to make sure that the order was passed down to release me without any harm.
Wow. The other point in his obituary that struck me was how crucial he became as a communicator of what was happening in Congo. How did he become this force in actually getting Congo's stories and news out to the wider world?
One of his qualities was that Pierre was a sort of amateur historian. When he died, I think he was 74 years old. Basically, his professional experience as a driver encompassed almost the entire independent political history of his country. And because he worked with reporters over the years, was also always in touch with politicians of various stripes. Mm. And so he had his own networks that sort of stemmed from these two interests. And this just gave him extraordinarily sound instincts. Pierre could, in uncanny ways, sort of sense things as they were about to happen. I worked in the Congo for 4 or 5 years. After a time, I didn't depend on Pierre so much for a network of contacts, but it was Pierre's gut that was the most important thing to me. Pierre knowing how disparate-seeming events were coming together and when it was important to pay attention to a particular thing. I've rarely seen an individual in any line of work who had such an acute sense of that as Pierre.
Howard French, former New York Times West Africa correspondent, helping us remember Pierre Mambele, Congolese driver, but really so much more. Howard, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
You're with the world. When unrest leads to violence in a place that gets little attention, how do you even notice the tipping point?
When needs are not met, when injustices are not tended to, there is a radicalization, there's an outflanking. And the great danger is that we reach a point of no return.
Staying away from that point in Central Africa, that's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The civil war in Yemen has been a humanitarian crisis as well as a military stalemate for 4 years. The United States backs one side in the war, but also is calling for a peace settlement. Martin Griffiths is the UN special envoy to Yemen, and he's in Washington, D.C. today, where he just finished briefing Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Martin Griffiths, what was the key message you delivered to Secretary of State Pompeo about Yemen?
My main message was, and indeed is, that we need to keep Yemen out of any potential regional conflict. Yemen has its own problems, its own war, as you've just said, and it's my first priority at the moment, I think, and it's true for all of us, to at least keep it out from being sucked into any potential regional conflict. And that was my main discussion with Secretary Pompeo. We also discussed other aspects of the things that we need to do in Yemen.
Isn't it too late for that? I mean, it's right in the center of a basically a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
I don't think it is too late. First of all, of course, you know, there isn't a shooting war yet in the region. Thank God for that. But also, I think that there are many voices in Yemen, including in the Houthi movement, who see their future in Yemen and not in any war between Iran and others. And so I think we need to focus quickly, seriously, urgently on de-escalation in Yemen, and in particular, of course, the attacks across the southern border into Saudi Arabia.
When you said it hasn't turned into a shooting war yet, a shooting war between Iran and Saudi Arabia directly.
That's right. That's right. And my fear, and I think it was behind your question, is that if that comes, that Yemen may be drawn into it. And that's not good for Yemen. That's actually not good for the region either. And of course, it's my priority to try to keep Yemen away from that and to focus Yemen on its own problems rather than those in the region. That was a discussion I was having with Secretary Pompeo.
So when you took on this job, Martin Griffiths, the two main sides in the civil war were not willing to meet each other, the government of President Abdrabo Mansur Hadi and the leaders of the Houthis. But you changed that in Sweden last year. They did meet. So what's the progress that's been made since then?
It's been slow. It's been grindingly slow since that time. But next Sunday, Monday, for example, the two sides will meet under the auspices of General Michael Lollesgaard, my colleague who runs the Hodeida mission, I hope to come to specific agreements on the demilitarization of those ports and improving humanitarian access in Hodeida. The fact that this is still happening 6 months or more after the signatures of that agreement in Sweden is remarkable, in fact, that the parties are still prepared to go at it, despite the frustrations that we all feel.
Is there a timetable to end the war?
Yeah, sort of yesterday, really, because the humanitarian situation constantly reminds us that we should not waste any time towards ending this war. My assumption is that ending of the war is what we should focus on. Building peace will be something that we can turn our attention to once we have achieved that goal. So an agreement to end the war should focus on ending the war and ushering in a new political arrangement. So let's make it simple, let's make it reductive, and let's make it quick.
As you keep telling anyone who will listen, the Yemeni people are the ones who really suffer from this war. What will their country look like the day after this war ends, whenever that is?
Relieved, I guess. Because of the terrible, terrible effects of the war and the many different wars, as you know, that are going on in different parts of Yemen. Relief that there's a chance for the markets to operate, the economy to return, that the divisions that now exist in Yemen will be over. But, as I think you're implying, it's just a first day, and the prospect of actually mending the wounds of the war is a generational one. And it is so in most wars, but particularly in Yemen. The prospects of local reconciliation, of communities living together when they have been fighting each other, the prospects of reconstruction are going to be phenomenal. The story starts the day after we succeed in getting the war stopped. That's when the hard work begins.
Martin Griffiths, the UN Special Envoy to Yemen, speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on the program.
When we talk about the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border, we tend to focus on those immigrants who trek to the border from Mexico and Central America. They are the majority there, but you'll also find migrants from much farther afield. Cameroon, for example. Cameroon is one of many countries where turmoil is pushing people to flee. The country's government is facing threats from multiple insurgencies. That includes the armed militants of Boko Haram. At the same time, separatists in two English-speaking regions in the west of the country are in revolt. David Miliband is just back from Cameroon, where he was tracking the humanitarian crisis caused by all of this turmoil. Miliband heads the International Rescue Committee and is a former British Foreign Secretary. He says he met desperate people in Cameroon.
They talked about utter desolation, about places that are now uninhabitable, but also about a conflict that is growing and more people fleeing. And that speaks to the very difficult civilian, military, diplomatic situation in the north of Cameroon and in the neighboring countries around the Lake Chad itself.
Did you meet one family or one person whose story really struck you that kind of crystallizes what's going on there?
And what comes to mind is four community workers that we have employed. They're there to promote hygiene, to fight cholera effectively. And there was just a vacancy in their eyes when I talked to them about what they had left behind. These were farmers. They talked about the utter desolation that came with the violence. They talked about the people that they had lost. They had, in very, very difficult conditions, ensured that there wasn't a public health outbreak of a cholera base. When I talked to them about whether they'd ever go back, there was utter loss. There was no confidence that either national authorities or international authorities would be able to offer hope. And the only thing that they could live for was their own work and also the opportunities that might exist, that might conceivably exist in the future for their children who were going to a local school.
Does that suggest this violence is just going to continue?
Well, I think that there is real danger of a metastasizing of the conflict. We know that the armed opposition groups are splitting. We know that they are becoming increasingly violent. We know that in some cases they are connecting up. And obviously the International Rescue Committee is a humanitarian organization. We're treating the symptoms of the crisis, not the roots of it. But we live within a political situation where you reach a point where there's so much bloodshed that it becomes harder and harder to patch things together again. And I think that this is something where there is a grave international hole. There's a grave hole in the international response, both at the humanitarian level and at the political diplomatic level.
As if Boko Haram wasn't enough, Cameroon is also dealing with a separatist crisis in its English-speaking regions. What did you see on that?
Yes, you've got 1,600 people killed in exactly as you describe it, a clash between separatists and the armed forces of the Cameroonian government. And someone, one of our own workers, said something very, very interesting to me. She said that, look, 20 or 30 years ago, more power for the Anglophone region was the demand. Then the demand became federalism. Then the demand became separatism. And you see that when needs are not met, when injustices are not tended to, there is a radicalization, there's an outflanking. And the great danger is that we reach a point of no return. And when you read the reports or hear the reports of people having their hands chopped off, when you know literally their hands and fingers chopped off, when you know that 1,600 people have lost their lives, you worry about the stability of the country because untended humanitarian crisis leads to political instability.
We are also seeing more and more reports of Cameroonians fleeing their country and ending up on the U.S.-Mexico border, many unable to cross now with this U.S. metering policy. How much do you attribute that migration to the violent pressure that's going on back home, Boko Haram, the separatist crisis back in Cameroon?
The fact that there has been a massive cut in the number of refugees being resettled, given asylum in the U.S. by the U.S. government, and President Trump has cut the number of refugees from 90,000 to 22,000, that cuts off a legal route to hope for people. And I had people in Cameroon saying, what's happened to refugee resettlement in America? And all I could tell them was the government has reduced by 3/4 the number of slots that are available. And what I would say is that those people have a right to have their asylum claims dealt with in an efficient and fair way.
David Miliband, former UK Foreign Secretary and the head of the International Rescue Committee, just back from Cameroon. Thank you very much, as always.
Thank you very much indeed.
As we just heard, the turmoil across parts of Africa is pushing many people on the continent to take desperate measures. That includes migration, typically to Europe, but increasingly also across the Atlantic and north to the U.S.-Mexico border. As we just noted, few of those African asylum seekers are getting into the U.S. these days, though. So those camped out at the border are growing frustrated. Yesterday, more than 100 African migrants at the San Diego-Tijuana border held a protest. They blocked the path of vans used to transport asylum seekers across the border to the U.S. Max Rivlin-Nadler covers immigration for station KPBS in San Diego, and he watched the situation unfold.
After the sixth day of almost nobody being called to enter the United States, the Cameroonian migrants, along with a few other people from African countries, decided that enough was enough and that they were going to block the entry to the driveway that takes the van of migrants in protest of what they perceived to be corruption and basically people buying those very few slots that allow people to enter the United States.
What exactly is the gist of the grievances from the protesters?
What they believe is that the Mexican immigration officials are being bribed by people who speak Spanish. This is a huge barrier for Cameroonians, by either Central Americans, Cubans, Haitians, you know, who have a better grasp of Spanish, people who are basically able to use connections in some way to get to the top of the list and get those really valuable slots. The Mexican immigration officials have countered, no, of course we don't take bribes. We would never do something like that.
Are, in fact, people buying higher numbers on the entry waiting lists?
one thing that has been witnessed by many immigration advocates, as well as people waiting in line, is that Mexican immigration authorities will announce there are no numbers being called today. But sure enough, a van filled with people who are being taken over to the U.S. for asylum does leave that little van port that got blocked yesterday and take people to the U.S. side. So the questions then become, how did those people get into that van? How are they chosen? Again, a few of them were chosen by Mexican immigration officials because of pressing health needs. And everybody who on either side kind of agrees that those people should be given exceptions. But that being said, that doesn't really account for what many people see as a lot of people who did not wait, that quote unquote, wait their turn.
How raucous a scene was yesterday's protest and how was it resolved?
It got pretty heated because you had 100 people standing in front of Mexican immigration authorities who, for the most part, have been overwhelmed. They didn't engage with the protesters. Instead, what ended up happening is Mexican immigration officials grabbed, it seemed quite by random, 8 people to take into the port of entry, where they then negotiated with them for over an hour over how the Cameroonians could kind of verify that the list is being called each day and that the people whose number it is on the list are the ones actually being offered the slots to enter the United States. They emerged from that hour-long negotiation. The leaders of the Cameroonian delegation said, we've reached an agreement. We're going to send 2 representatives each morning to verify that these numbers are being called. We're going to rotate who those 2 people are so they don't become powerful in of themselves. And basically, the protest was dispersed after that.
Right. Well, you met a man from Cameroon, Max, who only gave you his first name, Douglas. He said he'd been waiting in Tijuana for at least 2 months, and he met with Mexican officials.
Right now, we are trying to solve a problem. We don't want to start with threats. You say, if you don't do this, we do this. If you don't do this, we do this. That one is not good.
So he's trying to negotiate. You also spoke with a woman named Beatrice. Where was she from?
Beatrice is also from Cameroon. She was one of the first people to sit down in front of the carport that would take the van to the U.S. And she expressed just how kind of desperate the situation had become for the Cameroonians in Tijuana.
The immigration officers here, they are corrupt. We have been here for 3 months. People who come just 2 days, that spends 2 days here, they get in. But us, we are still here.
So peaceful resolution to yesterday's protests in Tijuana, but this problem on the border in Tijuana, it's not going away, is it?
It's not going away. Yesterday, the list reached over 9,000 people, which is the longest it's ever been. Again, this is the unofficial list that's right, being kept by Mexican immigration authorities. Each day, more and more Cameroonians and Africans and people generally from Equatorial Africa flood into Tijuana. But the numbers that have come in, we're talking now thousands of Africans, which is a total demographic shift from what was earlier this year and at the end of last year.
Max Rivlin Nadler covers immigration for KPBS, San Diego's public media station. He's been speaking with us about the increasing number of African migrants arriving at the U.S. southern border. Thanks very much, Max.
Thank you.
In France, a workplace bullying trial is wrapping up tomorrow. The case is before a criminal court in Paris, and the details are pretty grim. It starts 10 years ago when France Telecom wanted to downsize. But under the country's generous labor laws, workers at the former national phone company had jobs for life. So the executives there allegedly tried to make the workers' lives as miserable as possible so they'd quit. But instead, some of the workers took their own lives. At least 35 France Telecom employees committed suicide. And now their former bosses are on trial. Sarah Waters is a professor of French studies at Leeds University in the UK, and her research focuses on work suicides in France. What is the allegation exactly about France Telecom? How bad were conditions that workers killed themselves?
At France Telecom, there was a very particular situation in which when the company privatized back in the 1990s, it had a strategic plan to cut 22,000 jobs in the space of 3 years. But what happened was it found it couldn't get rid of the staff by legal formal means because its staff had protected status. They were public service employees, which meant they couldn't be legally fired. So what the bosses did was they put in place a set of more perverse psychological strategies to try to push the staff to leave of their own accord.
Like what kind of tactics?
In some cases, they forced workers to move from jobs 300 miles away in new cities. In other cases, you had workers who were demoted. You had highly skilled engineers and technicians who were forced to work in call centers on the phone lines. You have other cases of employees who were forgotten. A branch would close and staff would move to a new office, but particular workers wouldn't be told, and they would find themselves left behind in an empty office.
So do you believe 35 suicides is all there were?
Well, according to trade unions, there were far more suicides. 35 suicides were selected by lawyers to go through the courts, but there were a far greater number of suicides. In fact, the trade unions recorded 60 suicides between 2006 and 2010. One of the interesting elements in the case is that trade unions were aware very early on what was going on, and they decided to record each suicide that was taking place. So every time an employee took his or her own life, they made a record of that, because at the time, management was in complete denial about what was going on.
Why didn't these employees just quit?
That's an interesting question. The employees who took their own lives had a similar profile. These were employees who'd worked at the company for over 30 years. They were mostly in their 50s. They defined themselves in relation to their job. And so all of a sudden, they found that their professional life was turned upside down. And it not only affected their work, but their whole sense of who they were. These guys had been very much brought up in the idea of French public service, that you're working on behalf of the nation, you are performing in your job a service for the French nation.
So, Sarah, what are France's generous labor laws that the bosses at France Telecom were allegedly trying to get around, and why does France have them?
So, France has a tradition of providing stable, protected jobs, good salaries, good pensions, steady income. That has been the traditional labor model in France. There isn't necessarily for the employee great career opportunities. They're not going to be promoted very rapidly. But what you have in exchange is security, is a job for life. And so this is a very typical and traditional French model, which, of course, is now undergoing very rapid change because of the labor laws put in place by President Hollande and then by Emmanuel Macron, because they now want to undo this labor model because they feel that it is unattractive for the global economy. It is unattractive for foreign investment. It dissuades companies from hiring people because the labor laws are seen to be so rigid.
I would think this case would sway public opinion in France to Emmanuel Macron's side, undoing France's labor laws. Am I right?
No, I don't think so. I think that people feel that what needs to happen now is that there needs to be greater consideration for the individual worker. You have to remember that in France, it wasn't just France Telecom which was affected by suicides. There were also suicides in the banks, in supermarkets. At Disneyland in Paris, there was a spate of worker suicides. So not only did suicides affect protected workers, they also affected insecure workers in other companies. So I don't think the suicides were caused by the labor protections in place. What happened was almost a perverse response to them.
Are work suicides a bigger problem in France than in other countries?
Well, what I would say is that in France, work suicides have been far more visible. They have received far more attention in the media and in political life. We have to remember that in France, the companies which were worse affected were previously state-owned companies where the state was involved. The government sat on the board of directors. The government was the main shareholder in France Telecom when the suicides were taking place. Mm. So work suicide in France has has been politicized. It has been the focus of intense media attention. But this does not mean that work suicide rates are higher in France than anywhere else.
With the Telecommunication Workers Labor Union of France documenting many of these suicides, what is your prognosis for France's labor laws and the trial?
I think what is important about this case is that it's the first time that individual bosses have been held personally, criminally responsible for their management decisions. And this will have huge repercussions for other multinational corporations. You can't simply put an employee under intense pressure and require them to meet impossible targets. You can't do that. Employers need to take on board the holistic human dimension of a worker or an employee and not push them into the ground.
Professor Sarah Waters at Leeds University, her focus of study is work suicides in France. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's where we leave things on the radio today. When you can't find us on air, you can always find us online 24/7 at theworld.org. The World's theme music is by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.